Swedish-British journalist, filmmaker, political writer, and author of 5 books, Pelle Nyroff-Taylor, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nyroff-Taylor Show. On the second hour of this Monday afternoon, we've got two brilliant guests. We've got Fox Green's, an independent filmmaker and journalist who's doing a series on energy and how the globalist empire uses food and energy to prevent nation building and control the world. That's an original angle, which I'll take up. We've also got Shankara Chetty, a doctor in South Africa, who will tell us about how he successfully used a method to treat thousands of patients suffering from COVID and saving them from hospitalization and death, and how he's being targeted by the authorities of that country in quite a predictable manner. We'll be talking about the latest from Iran and Israel story with Basil Valentine at 10 past. But first, I'll just talk a little bit about another story that kind of been missing the headlines, but is nevertheless quite important. A lot of people have wondered why Macron, having been the guy who reached out to Putin back in 2022, has suddenly escalated his rhetoric and become one of the most hawkish leaders in the West. Well, I mean, there's a joke going that Kremlin propagandists were circulating the rumors that his wife, this Brigitte, was actually a transgender man, and judging by the size of her feet and quite fun things like that. Maybe she is, I don't know. But more seriously, I think that the motive is certainly got something to do with the fact that Northwest Africa, which has been a French preserve for over 100 years, and is much more closely tied to the mother country than the British former colonies in East Africa, let alone Australia and so on, are kind of turning towards Russia. And it's been, it's quite astonishing, because I've studied a little bit of history of West Africa and Central Africa, and I know that the French were extremely worried about Soviet encroachment in the 1960s. It was actually far less than what's going on today. And of course, Sarkozy, then French president, was one of the most active leaders in favor of the toppling of Gaddafi, because Gaddafi was making inroads into French West Africa with his talk about a pan-African currency, which would threaten the euro-based Central African and West African franc, which has its roots in the French franc, African franc tie. And of course, Niger, which is one of the countries that Russians are sending advisors into, has uranium and things like that. So what's happened is that there was a big counterterrorism operation going on in the years 2014 to 22, which saw a big rise in the French military buildup in these semi-desert countries like Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, Senegal, and I think Chad. And these countries, the northern part of Sahara, the southern part is this kind of bushland, and they don't have a lot. They do have some mineral resources, but they're among Africa's poorest countries. But they tie up the French-speaking North Africa to the French-speaking prosperous West African countries like Senegal and Ivory Coast. However, in 2022, the French military was forced to leave Mali, whose government was angry that this anti-terrorist operation failed to achieve its objectives. France also had to pull out of Burkina Faso and relocated its personnel, its military personnel, to Niger, whose president, Mohamed Bazoum, was considered loyal to Paris. However, there was a military takeover in July last year, 2023, apparently supported by a lot of Nigerian. And this new government, led by a guy called Tchiani, has demanded that the French military pull out from the region. So the French soldiers have finally left the Niger Republic in December 2023. And what's happening is this Tchiani government is even calling for an end of the United States presence, which is a base situated contemporaneously and parallelly to the French ones. Who is taking their place? Well, one thing is interesting. I met a journalist for Radio France International, and who kind of gave me the heads up on this when I met her last year in France. And she said that the French, these former French colonies, are throwing out the French cultural institutes, and they're closing the broadcast frequencies and local offices of Radio France International, which is the French equivalent to the World Service. And who'd have thunk it? Who's coming in their place? Well, it's Russia Today, RT, and Russian cultural institutes and Russian advisors from the Wagner Group. So Macron is, and if not least his military advisors, you know, there's a deep cultural affinity or whatever nostalgia about these semi-desert countries in Northwest Africa. And I wouldn't be surprised if that is putting a lot of pressure. And if there's going to be a conflict in Ukraine or maybe in Northwest West Africa, that could be an upcoming thing. I just thought I'd give you a heads up there, is if the world doesn't have enough to worry about. And one of the hottest and most dangerous situations is, of course, the situation in Israel and Iran today, which Basil is going to talk to us about after a very quick break. This is the Pelinirov Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back with our political editor after the break.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, Basil, our political editor. I guess you've been glued to the wires to see if there's any developments on this Israeli war cabinet meeting.
Good afternoon, Pelle. Yes, it's sort of all quiet on the Western Front for the time being. The Guardian publishing an opinion piece by Dalia Schneiderlin saying that an all-out conflict dragging in other regional powers may be someone's idea of national security, but it isn't mine. She speaks as an Israeli citizen. Meanwhile, the Belgian government is the latest to have summoned its Iranian ambassador to strongly condemn the attack. Iraq has called on all parties to show restraint amid soaring tension. And Iran itself says it will respond more strongly than before if Israel retaliates. And the talk is that they may send missiles to destroy the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona. That would represent a significant escalation. But at the moment, very, very tense standoff. I want to pivot actually to the ministers' conference about Sudan, that dreadful Baerbock woman, the German foreign minister, is been speaking at the Paris conference, saying that the child displacement in Sudan is the biggest crisis of its type in the world. What we're witnessing in Sudan is the worst child displacement crisis in the world. In many of our countries, as the war enters its second year, it is practically absent from our daily news. She went on to say, every life counts equally, whether in Ukraine, in Gaza, or in Sudan. Well, you could have fooled me, Pelle. It seems that lives in Ukraine are very much prioritized over those in Gaza. She's been one of the biggest cheerleaders for That's the right. genocide, and Germany now finds itself in the dock at the ICJ. And she now has the temerity to speak up about Sudan. She's a Green. I thought the Greens were sort of, you know, bedfellows with the campaign for nuclear disarmament and the peaceniks, Pelle.
I know.
The Greens seem to be occupying a very bizarre place. It's the so-called far right, the AfD, that are the peaceniks. And the Greens are warmongers. It's all turned upside down, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they call them the camouflage Greens, you know, or fatigue Greens or whatever. And I guess if there is infiltration by other intelligence agencies, it was likely to be one of those smaller parties, especially in a political system where they can have the balance of power. And I know some of the smaller parties run by attractive women in Scandinavia, like that Sanna Marin. I mean, they're like kind of NATO shills. I don't know if they've been actually infiltrated, just ideologically infiltrated. But I think some of the founders of the Greens were Nazis, you know. So, I mean, if they are the real far right, the Greens, back in the 1980s, when, you know, if you were in your 60s, you would still be a guy who'd served in the Wehrmacht in 1944. So I just have a Dirk Puhlmann, who's a host here, knows all about that.
Yes,
he was a young Green, and he's talked about his disillusionment because he realized it were literally Nazis who founded the old Green Party. And of course, Hitler was a vegetarian, wasn't he?
Yes,
anti-smoking and all the rest of it. So
that's right. There's a sort of Volkisch, is that the right term, Perry?
You know,
a sort of folk culture bucolic and very nostalgic, really, for the past, which permeates Green Party politics in Germany and which could be linked directly back to Nazism, you know, with a strong emphasis on rural, traditional German culture.
That's right. Well, it's all very strange and quite interesting, but
Yes, but anyway, back to the Sudan. Save the Children said that in the first 105 days of this year, the amount of money raised for the humanitarian crisis in Sudan is less than a fifth of what was pledged in just 2 days to rebuild the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. I thought that was a rather interesting statistic. Arif Noor, the country director, said, "It's staggering that after a fire in which nobody died, donors from across the world were so moved to pledge funds to restore the Notre Dame Cathedral. Meanwhile, children in Sudan are left to fend for themselves as war rages around them, starvation and disease are on the increase, and almost the entire country's child population has been out of school for a year."
Mm. Sudan was famous. Do you remember the Darfur? That was about 20 years ago. And there was a lot of talk about child soldiers back in 2004, 2005. And there was a book called Emma's War about a woman who was British, and she married one of the warlords, and they adopted some of the child soldiers. And one of the child soldiers went on to become a pop star in England. Anyway, I followed that story because I wrote about it. But these child soldiers, I mean, all they need is some ganja weed or whatever, and then all they need is a machine gun, and they'll shoot people. So they're really tarred, they're really scarred for life. Anyway, that's my thought about children in Sudan, that child soldiers are often used and exploited by other people because they really are fearless. But it also reminds me back of the Ethiopian thing back in the 1980s, you know, with Michael Burke on the BBC talking about biblical scenes. Maybe it's a good thing if we can get back to talking about saving people's lives in that way rather than all this war stuff.
Some people would say that this Paris conference is another version of imperialism. It's being held in a typically gilded Second Empire room in Paris, you know, where the wallpaper alone is worth more than most Sudanese families earn in a lifetime. Do you know what I mean?
That's right.
And 25 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance, 9 million internally displaced or in neighbouring countries, according to Tejada Dowen McKenna, CEO of the NGO Mercy Corps, who told reporters Sudan is out of time. Civil war, of course, ravages that country, even after it was split into two and we had the creation of South Sudan, which was supposed to, draw a line between the sub-Saharan black African populations of the south and the Arab populations of the north. Because, of course, Sudan, once again, as we've discussed before, Pelly, one of these countries whose borders stem directly from the colonial era and grouped together, in that case, both black Africans and Arabs inside the same administrative and political region.
Yeah, and the Arabs were, they were the imperial power and incredibly exploitative of the blacks. And something that the American Christians really got engaged in. Janjaweed or something they were called, these guys on horseback.
Yes, that's right.
These Arabs with the kind of a vicious sort of hunters down. I mean, of course, Arabs were leading figures in old slavery terms, you know, more even than the Americans. So there was that overlay. So if we're talking about Western imperialism, we can also talk about Arab imperialism from the north. But anyway, this country split off. Well, it's interesting anyway that I think we have to pay attention to what's going on in these countries. And Sudan is certainly a sort of, and it's of course right next to the other countries I was talking about, Niger and Chad and so on. Do you think,
As regards to the other situation, of course, it's 20 past 11 in the morning at the White House. I would imagine Joe Biden is just getting up, as it were. And doubtless there are hotlines, diplomatic channels absolute flurry of activity at the UN directly between Biden and Netanyahu. Biden apparently has told Netanyahu to take the win. David Cameron also referred to it as a double win for Israel because the defense mechanisms work so well in cutting out 99% of the drones. As you said earlier, if Iran had really wanted to do some damage, they could have done using big missiles, but they didn't. It was largely symbolic gesture.
That's right.
By the looks of it.
And what worries me, we'll finish there.
Is to draw a line there. Go on.
Yeah. We hope they could all draw a line, but what worries me is that all this soft soaping of the Israelis, take it as a win, will just embolden them. And all our bated breath, sort of speculation about what the Israelis are going to do next, and then these pictures in the front of the page of the Telegraph with a jet plane about to take off. I don't know if that's the wisest psychological thing for the Israelis. Maybe we should talk it down the way some press outlets have been doing, but not this almost salivating approach from the Telegraph. I think it's really disgusting.
Great.
Anyway, Basil, talk to you tomorrow. This is Pelinneros Taylor Show on TNT News Talk, and we've got our third guest coming up after a very quick break. This is the Pelinneros Taylor Show. Thank you.
TNT's Jason Olborn.
Former Liberal Democrat Senator David Leinhelm, who was the first Liberal Democrat senator, he wrote a book on gun control a couple of years ago. And I would have to say, from an Australian perspective, it is the definitive book on the subject. And we're going to talk about that in line with another pressing thing that happened for us here in Australia just a week or so ago, with the digital ID bill being passed in the Senate in its first reading as opposed to the House of Representatives, and leading to many people saying that in Australia, it may be that this push is on because we don't have access to arms. It's an interesting argument, isn't it? And what I noticed was that it was coming not only from Australian social media, but also from people in the United States, where there's been this pressure ongoing for gun control in that country.
Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinneros Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. We're very pleased to welcome Fox Green, who's an independent filmmaker, journalist, podcast host, and artist fighting the information war against the forces of entropy and anti-humanism. He's an ardent advocate for peaceful cooperation between the brother nations of the USA, China, and Russia. He's going to tell us how the globalist empire, well, he's going to have to define that, uses food and energy to prevent nation building and ultimately control the world. Welcome to the show, Fox.
Thank you for having me.
What is the globalist empire?
I think people are aware of it. They don't define it really, but a lot of people are aware of it. They think of it as globalism. They think of it as the World Economic Forum. It manifests as the Anglo-American Empire, which is currently at war with the rest of the world, stirring up conflicts, and basically preventing countries from developing while keeping the developing countries underdeveloped or deindustrialized. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a multi-front operation, both economic and hot warfare. Yeah.
What intrigued me about your work is that we often talk about control, military control, or economic control, control of the currency, control of the media, psychological persuasion. But of course, what is the most fundamental form of control? It's control of food, because we all need to eat. And so can we explore that theme a little bit? Because and energy, how do the globalists exploit food against the global south and the world's population?
Sure. I mean, you could frame it all around work, right? So people need food to do work, to perform, you know, work in order to live, to get their basic needs met. And then on a higher level, on a societal level, to perform tasks, to create infrastructure so that more people can do work. It's all a system of people burning energy to do work. And the more energy that people have in the form of food, it's just like the way you put gas in your car, right? or fuel in your machines to perform the work. Well, we're the same way, right? Human beings need calories, energy to perform work and to live. So it's all based on this idea of food. We became a society. We transitioned from hunter-gatherer to actual human societies because of the advent of agriculture, because we were able to control the forces of nature and sustain ourselves in a way that made us more stable, that made life less precarious. And little by little, we've built upon that in order to do bigger and better things as human beings that have the capacity for reason and creativity. But you can't do that if you're constantly running away from a tiger or trying to chase down your next meal.
But in what way is the West or the globalists trying to control food production or food distribution concretely?
I mean, we see it with the farmer protests. Those are all over Europe. We saw it in Canada. We're starting to see some of it in the United States. What is another way? Controlling food. There are all kinds of...
It's okay. Kissinger said control oil. Yeah.
What I'm trying to get at is there have been lots of factories and farms burned down. It's not really reported on much in the U.S., but I feel what's funny to me is I feel like people are seeing these things. So it's funny to put it into specific words that I think a lot of people are seeing the crunch on this stuff. So they don't really need. There's also solar panels are being used to cut down on farmland. You're located in Australia, right?
Sweden, but the channel has an Australian base. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you're not seeing it as much in Sweden.
I live in a farming community actually, but there was a tractor protest the other day. It's rather sweet. There's about five tractors going around the local square, but I know from television that the farming protests all over the place. And that's apparently got to do with European regulations that are strangling farmers. And that's kind of bureaucratic overreach.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know if it's, and I also know food prices have gone up, obviously. And then I know that the Russians have been selling or giving away grain to states in Africa, as a result of which they seem to be getting closer to Russia and being more favorable to Russia. But I don't know what else. I mean, it's an incredibly interesting topic, isn't it? Because it's such an obvious, apparently in Gaza, I mean, that's starvation is policy there, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, I mean, this is so overreaching. It's we just saw aid workers who were handing out food to, the Palestinians getting, blown apart by the Israeli forces. So food is a weapon at every single level. It's the air we breathe at this moment.
But you're connecting it to energy because is it right that you've got a documentary series called Energy/Empire?
Correct.
And you link that to food because we need energy. Can you tell us about that documentary series and what it's about?
Sure. So it's a five-part series, and it explores different topics and different people, particularly two island nations, Cuba and Sri Lanka. And then it explores the role of people like Vandana Shiva and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's running for president in the United States, and the roles that they've played in these countries in particular to impose certain regulations on food and energy. To undermine the sovereignty of these nations and to play a geopolitical game that is ultimately against the human race and human progress.
We're going to news break in a few seconds, but are you saying RFK did this? Because he's supposed to be a kind of progressive hero. Is he? He doesn't have that kind of position, does he, to impose stuff on Cuba, does he?
Oh, no, he absolutely does.
Oh, he does. Okay.
He actually went to Cuba.
We'll leave on that cliffhanger. RFK is a sort of hero of centrists everywhere because he's neither Trump and he's a youngster in the US presidential race, at the stripling, a child at the age of 70, and very popular with independence. He is apparently a villain. We'll get back to that after a very quick news break. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
TNT Radio News.
We are your station for news.
News. TNT, this is James O'Neill. Over the weekend, Iran conducted a series of airstrikes against Israel as a retaliatory measure for the earlier bombing of an Iranian consular compound in Syria. President Joe Biden has advanced further in securing the Democratic nomination for re-election after winning party contests in Wyoming and Alaska. Tesla shares fell this morning following the company's announcement that it will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce due to declining demand for its electric vehicles amidst intense market competition.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Right, welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. We're very pleased to have Fox Green with us, who's an independent filmmaker and journalist and podcast host, and he's made a five-part series about energy and how RFK is a kind of a villain in some of that episode series. Why is RFK, in what way has he done bad things?
Well, the easiest entry point is to look at his record on nuclear energy. He has been a destructive force for nuclear energy here in the United States, but also internationally. And that's why the film focuses on the first part on Cuba, because he did go to Cuba in the early 90s with his brother in an effort to get Cuba, the Cuban government, to abandon their nuclear energy project that they had started with the USSR. But as we all know, the USSR collapsed in the early 90s. And their relationship with Cuba fell apart, right? They could no longer economically become a trade partner and support, you know, have a cooperative relationship. So this plant that was helped, you know, started by the Soviets was abandoned. And the U.S. sent a delegation with RFK and his brother to say, you know what, you guys don't need nuclear energy. You guys can just burn off biomass to make up for the lost energy that would have been created from this nuclear plant. And as most people know, or maybe they don't know, Cuba underwent a special period, is what they called it, a special period where they had basically an energy famine in the country. They didn't have enough food, they had rationing, and lots of people like to blame it on communism and say, see, this is why communism doesn't work, and everyone, you know, who becomes a communist ultimately fails. But what they don't realize, with the story behind the picture, the picture behind the story, is that there are certain people who convince the government to abandon high energy density projects, such as the Holgara nuclear plant, which, you know, they tried to restart with Putin a few years back. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. put its thumb down on that as well. So here's a nation of people who are just trying to develop and create sovereignty for their people, create wealth and energy. And we have people from the U.S. saying no. Now, RFK has a strong history of stopping nuclear energy from being built and shutting it down right here in New York State in my backyard. I live in the Hudson Valley, about 2 hours north of New York City. There was a nuclear power plant called Indian Point, which produced a quarter of the energy for New York City. And that, this is clean energy that supposedly all the environmentalists love so much, clean energy that produces no CO2 emissions. RFK was head of an organization called Riverkeeper. This was his career before he became a politician. You know, people usually know him for his anti-vaccine advocacy, but he is an environmentalist. And a big part of his role as an environmental lawyer has been to litigate firm energy sources in order to shut them down. So he was successful in shutting down a major, one of them, probably the biggest power plant in New York State. So part of what he does is he shuts down firm energy, not only internationally, but at home. We have the same enemy. And this is what the documentary is trying to get across, is that the enemy is not left or right or communist or socialist or capitalist or whatever. It's people who are trying to stop the development of nations and the ability for people to do work to build society in a manner that will make everyone healthy, happy, prosperous, and live wonderful
lives. I think
lives.
What that story about RFK is a real eye-opener. You've got a real scoop there. I mean, I follow the US non-mainstream media quite closely, and you know, he's a bit of a hero and regarded as a truth teller. And I'm very pro-nuclear, and it's a real surprise. And I can't resist telling this joke because it features his uncle, I guess it was, Ted Kennedy. And the joke is, more people died at Chappaquiddick than at Three Mile Island.
As somebody who's been to Chappaquiddick, yes, I'm very aware of the all the ghosts that live there. And that's really good talking point. I'm going to start using that because it's absolutely true. Yeah.
You're welcome to steal it. Chappaquiddick is, of course, Ted Kennedy, for a non-American audience, is a place, a bridge, I think, in Massachusetts or somewhere, where Ted Kennedy was the younger brother of JFK and RFK's uncle. When a young man, he was drunk, I think, he crashed a car, and his secretary or girlfriend or something, she died at the back because he didn't open the door for her when the book. Anyways, and Harrisburg or Three Mile Island is a nuclear power plant, which actually contributed to the fact that all over Europe, there was a closure of power plants based on this kind of fake idea that Harrisburg, Three Mile Island was some terrible nuclear disaster. And even very educated people get this completely wrong, just as they get Chernobyl completely wrong. I mean, even though that was the worst nuclear disaster in history, the number of people who died was in the dozens, and then they had some thyroid cancers. But I mean, it's far less than the number of people who died in coal mines every year in China. But anyway, so what is your conclusion then? When you've got this 5-part series, what do you want the takeaway message to be when people have seen it, and what do you want them to think?
I want them to reframe how we look at the world and geopolitics, right? Is that we see a world divided, where it's our nations versus their nations, and this is a game that's played to keep people of the world apart, to try to say, well, what they want is different from what we want, and we're all fundamentally different. But the truth of the matter is that most people just want peace, prosperity. Most people do not want war, whether it's military conflicts or economic warfare. Most people just want to work hard and create a better world for their children. And the powers that be want to muddy the waters and make us think that countries like Russia and China are fundamentally opposed to the Western hegemony, and that we need to be the bullies of the world and keep everyone else from doing their thing. And fear mongering about China has gotten insane because China is presenting a different paradigm to the world. China is with the Belt and Road Initiative, World Land Bridge. They're helping the rest of the world develop. And that is fundamentally different from what we've seen from the Anglo-American perspective that has been running the world with America as its bulldog since the 20th century. We did not win World War II. The Nazis were simply transmuted into new institutions, predominantly NATO, which is what we see today. And this Anglo-American empire really needs to end. We need a reorganization of world, you know, infrastructure. Where the powerful nations can come together.
Yep. We've got to wind up there. We can find your stuff on spacecommune.com, Fox G Green on Twitter/X, and your 5-part series, is that available on YouTube or some other video channel somewhere?
Yep, it's available on Rumble and YouTube, BitChute. The first part is out. Next 5 parts, or 4 parts, sorry, are coming out over the course of the year. So if you want to support us in helping produce those, we would appreciate that greatly.
All right. So I highly recommend, you're looking at food, you're looking at energy, and you are tying it together. And in this idea that sort of we don't really need to fight at all. And at the same time, which is, I guess, you're sort of leftist, you're quite pro-nuclear, which I am too, and I always have been. So check that out on Rumble and Fox G Green on Twitter, X. Thanks a lot, Fox. This is the Pelinieroff-Taylor Show on TNT, and we're finally going to have our final guest, Shankara Chetty, after a very quick break.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Are you ready to help your family get prepared for the unexpected?
Here we go!
Ladybug and Cat Noir know how important it is to be ready, because you never know when Hawk Moth is going to strike or a disaster will hit. And you don't need miraculous powers. Just put those planning skills you already have to good use. Make a plan that will help you and your family be ready when emergencies happen. Ready Kids can help. Get started at ready.gov/kids.
Pella Neuroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Monday afternoon. Our final guest today is Dr. Shankara Chetty, who treated 14,000 patients suffering from COVID. None of them, 0.0%, required hospitalization, no oxygen, no deaths, no need for COVID injections, sometimes called the death vax. They came from all over South Africa, or all over his neighborhood in South Africa, to consult him, old, young, infirm, and the chronically sick, those with comorbidities such as obesity, diabetes, or heart problems. All of them came and none of them died. So he has, this doctor has decades of experience in rural health, which are built on an impeccable reputation founded on a passion for his work. A deep knowledge and understanding of his profession. He honors the Hippocratic Oath, which says, first, do no harm. Well, he certainly didn't do any harm, but this was not good for the Health Professional Council of South Africa, which charged him and asked him to attend a disciplinary inquiry last year. According to Shankara's claims, he says that it made a complete mockery of his fundamental human rights and the South African Constitution. He was accused of unprofessional conduct and contravening ethical rules, which required healthcare practitioners to only use health technologies which have been proven. Dr. Shankara Chetty, thank you for joining us on this show. What a story, eh? So you've saved fantastic, you've done a fantastic job. You're one of those COVID heroes, but you fell foul of the authorities because you didn't follow their rules. Tell us your story from the beginning.
I took the opportunity when COVID started in the world to try and understand the illness, what we were dealing with, the information out there. And very early on, Pello, I realized that we have an insert in the virus. That means it was made in a lab, and I expected to see some unusual pathology with it. And I thought the only way to solve the problem would be to examine the patient and figure out how they were getting to that demise to try and negate it. I found very, very early on that we were dealing with a biphasic illness. People were getting the virus and recovering from it. But there was a small subset who again took a turn after recovering from the initial viral illness. And that turn seemed to occur exactly a week after the initial onset of the illness. So that week brought on a period of recovery. And then suddenly a week later, there was a subset that suddenly worsened again. That worsening was very sudden, very aggressive, and led to a decompensation very quickly. Now, there are only two things that can do that to you pathophysiologically. One's a severe allergic reaction to an allergen, and the other is an exposure to a venom. And if you don't treat either quickly, timeously, and aggressively, you'll have that patient run into problems. And so I understood this. I started treating it as such, as an allergic process that was triggered by some sort of viral debris. And in doing that, I got great success. I had people recover overnight. And of course, when you treat a bee sting, it's quick and aggressive treatment, and you get quick recovery from it. In seeing that, I knew I'm dealing with something unusual. And of course, my radar was out on the spike protein, which was part of that insert on the virus. And I thought, well, we're dealing with an insert, something new, and people that weren't exposed to this would probably react. In the second wave, I identified that viral debris or protein that was triggering reaction to spike protein. Now, being spike protein, I spoke out that spike protein is the primary pathogen of COVID illness. It's not the virus. We're chasing the wrong thing. And of course, using spike protein as the base of a mRNA vaccine campaign seemed nonsensical. You're putting the pathogen in people. You're getting the people's bodies to make a pathogen. And I expected that the vaccine campaign will see the same kind of illnesses we saw with COVID, but far more extreme. And so in late 2020, I started speaking out against the vaccine, that I expect that it's going to cause damage. The rest of the charges against me, Peter, were about my opinion, seeing how the pandemic unfolded. If this was, at that point, I knew it was a lab-made virus, and of course, there might be the possibility of a lab leak. If it was, we would have reacted in a particular way, tried to confine it, contain it, don't make a huge issue of it. But if it was intentional to be released and cause fear around the world with an agenda, then you would heighten the problem, make it bigger than it actually is. And that's what I saw happening. I also had people not listening, not willing to listen to what I was saying. So I knew that we had an emergency use authorization coming up for the vaccine, and my early treatment would negate that. And so I understood the push to keep me silent until the vaccine came out. The second thing that brought my attention to this being nefarious, I had absolutely no doubt that we were dealing with the toxic substance in spike protein. And the fact that it was put into a vaccine, that was a very bad omen. Now, knowing something is toxic is one thing. Forcing someone to take something that's toxic is a criminal act. And so I waited for the mandates. I knew once they mandated the vaccine, I could prove a criminal act. And so once the vaccine mandates came out, I started speaking out. I felt humanity was at risk, and I needed to tell them what I thought.
Sorry if I missed something, but we'll go on to the effects of your speaking out and the unpopularity you must have garnered in certain circles. But what was the reason for your 0% hospitalization? Did I just miss that, or what? Absolutely gripping story, but I.
Pili, the understanding of what caused the problem gave me the success. You got to treat what's in front of you. So I took the time to understand the illness, to understand what was happening, and of course, people say, "Oh, you didn't register for clinical trials and the rest." I had sick patients in front of me that were going to die, and I needed to step up and solve that problem. Now, as a simple case in point. I knew that these patients presenting back on that eighth day were having the second phase, responded to steroids. We knew steroids could be used in this illness. And so I put them on steroids, and I saw in the first 4 or 5 patients, it took 4 or 5 days for them to improve completely, get their oxygen sats up, feel a lot better. And then I thought, well, if I'm dealing with an allergic process, let me try an antihistamine and see whether that actually makes a difference. And so I put the fifth patient on a dose of Phenagan. And the next day, she was perfectly fine. The speed to recovery improved immensely. Now, with that, I took her off it the following day, and she worsened. I put her back on it. She improved. Clearly proving an antihistamine was beneficial and proving that my theory that this is likely to be an allergy is likely true. And that was the start. I couldn't not do that for the next patient. And so that was a simple clinical trial.
Steroids and then antihistamines. And was that your consistent method of cure? Did that work for all of them, or were only for some of them?
Yes, when I realized that we're dealing with an allergic process, then you, from the pathophysiology, understand that you're getting this flood of mediators being released by the trigger in this process, and you've got to mop up all those mediators and turn off the tap. The steroid stops the reaction, and then you've got to mop up what's released to prevent any further injury. And so it's the antihistamine. And when you talk antihistamine, there's different antihistamines for the gut and different antihistamines for the respiratory tract. You choose the right one. I added montelukast. Montelukast addresses leukotrienes that are released. And I added aspirin. Aspirin addresses platelet activating factor. With that combination of medications, antihistamines, montelukast, aspirin, and of course the steroid, a short course to stop the process, everyone recovered. And that's so incredible. There was no need to do anything else.
And what's more incredible is that a medical illiterate like me, you've explained it in a very exciting and very clear way. But I just got to ask, because I did a lot of reading up at the time, and I actually came down to South Africa. I did a story on something, and I brought back with me lots of ivermectin because you could get that prescribed more easily. Here in Europe, they stop stuff at customs if you order it. They're very, very restrictive in Europe. And but anyway, I mean, does ivermectin also work?
Ivermectin became a part of my understanding very early on in the pandemic period. I think it was about May 2020. I'd read an article that said ivermectin might be of benefit in this pandemic. I understood the pathophysiology, and I understood where ivermectin could be of benefit. You see, just a background on ivermectin. When we had antiparasitics previously and treated filaria, which is a lung parasite, the parasite died. But the dead parasite triggered an allergic response in the lung, and the host died of the allergy to the dead parasite. So here, I'm dealing with the dead virus. Now, ivermectin has an immunomodulatory benefit. So it became the gold standard for treating filaria because it suppressed that allergic reaction as well. So I thought, I'm dealing with a dead parasite or a dead virus in the lung. Maybe ivermectin would curb that response. And it did. But it wasn't the mainstay of my treatment. I don't think it addressed COVID completely, because a lot of people progressed into long COVID after that.
Right, okay. I mean, have you, your solution, let's say even ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, there's an interesting website that links to literally hundreds of papers on these things, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. And of course, the big clinical trials, there's one in Oxford, one carried out by the WHO. They were cancelled after this fraudulent article in The Lancet, which is one of the world's most famous medical journals. I mean, I don't know who put that out there, but it's utterly corrupt. Anyway, they stopped. But anyway, a lot of papers have been published. And to me, as a sort of, I did science at school, A-levels, and then mathematics and philosophy of science at university. So I know a little bit of my way around academic papers. It looks pretty convincing to me. Has anyone done a kind of trials or research onto your solution, which sounds, it's easy to understand the way you explain it to me, but it, obviously you would benefit from some kind of scientific backing? Yes.
I did publish an academic peer-reviewed paper, an observational and clinical tour of COVID early on in the pandemic, just to get the information out there and get the scientific debate going, point direction to research. Subsequently, I've had a professor from Texas University look at my work. Look, there's no point analyzing 14,000 patients who survived COVID. That doesn't tell us anything. So what I did was I gave him the case where I used an antihistamine to prove that it worked, it showed benefit. Subsequently, antihistamines have been shown to be of great benefit in COVID, and there's published papers on antihistamines, montelukast, aspirin, high-dose steroids. All of them have been shown in the research to be beneficial. I also gave him 20 of my most severe cases where I have blood results to prove that they improved. Telling someone that a patient had an oxygen saturation can be disputed. You can't dispute blood results. Now, I've got patients who came to me, those 20 cases, with interleukin 6 values. Over 85 is considered to be critically ill. I've had patients come to me with interleukin values of 400, and I've had it back down to normal within a week with this kind of treatment. So it shows how severe they were when they presented, and it shows how timeously they recovered within a week, with no hospitalizations, no need for anything extraneous, just a simple protocol and monitoring them to their point of recovery. So I've had other articles published about my work, researched, looked into the pathophysiology. I've also helped a government, Meghalaya, north of India. And in August 2021, they were at the height of their Delta wave. And they were having on average around 250 to 300 deaths a month from that wave, where previous to the wave, they were having 5 to 10 deaths a month. So it suddenly spiked. And I was called in August that year to train the rural doctors. I had already trained the ICU staff just before that. And with training those rural doctors, within a month or a month and a half, we brought that 300 death rate down to single to double digits. I think in the next month, they had 30 deaths. And the month after, it was 8. And then after that, too, now they're counting it in every 3 months because they're not having as many deaths. Now, approved in that country that a country nationwide implementation of the strategy can curb all the hospitalizations and deaths. Why it wasn't followed, I think there was an agenda.
Mm. So, well, this is a fantastic story. And I mean, really, a sort of good news story, but tragedy in the way because of all the things that weren't done if they'd followed your advice. Really, really, really interesting. But of course, you fell foul somehow of the South African, because you're based in South Africa, the South African health authorities. Tell us about your conflict with them and how it's played out.
I think the South African Health Professions Council, they have their financing from some corporates that have an agenda in this. They needed to silence me. I was going against the narrative, according to them, creating vaccine hesitancy. So they've questioned my views on the vaccine. I've mentioned that I think this is a bioweapon. It was intended to kill, intended to harm. They questioned my views on the pathophysiology of COVID and the treatment. So it covers everything about the pandemic. Now, they brought me to court hoping they would silence me. That ain't going to happen. Where we are at the moment, the charges that they brought don't match the original complaint. And the complaint was laid by a complainant that is conflicted in this matter, a professor that is supplying the government with tests, is part of a ministerial committee. So rather than shut me up, he should be debating me. So they brought the charges. We sent it back saying that the charges don't fit the crime. I gave them the opportunity to reformulate the charges. I want my opportunity. I don't want to win on a technicality. So where we sit now is that they brought a whole range of new charges. And those charges prove conclusively that there is prejudice against me by the council. So I'm planning to take those charges to the High Court and have this case seen in the High Court so that my testimonies and witness testimonies become court reference and court papers. And as well, any bias that I want to address at the start of my hearing sets precedent for cases going forward.
Dr. Chetty, we'll end on a sort of a personal note because we've got two and a half minutes left. If what you're saying is correct, steroids, antihistamines, aspirin, and a fourth thing I just missed is the solution to this health crisis, which has kind of devastated the world and changed a whole political and social system. If you're right, you've just kind of given away the formula for this. Do you not regret? I mean, is there any way you could have monetized this, or are you doing it for the good of humanity? Or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, Pelo, I think it's a calling. It's for humanity. My aim from the start was to share the knowledge. When I published the paper, when I wrote the paper, it was in May 2020. I gave it to everyone. I sent it to the Minister of Health. I didn't care if it was published. I didn't care about the acknowledgement. This was something that could save lives, and every person on the planet needed to know that. And so that was my mission, to share it with everyone. And with the case coming up, I don't care the outcome. I think more it's an opportunity to air truth. And so I want my opportunity to speak and narrate my journey through COVID so that people can be enlightened. And this will never happen again.
Dr. Chetty, where can we find your papers, and where can we find your tweets, or where we can keep you updated on the South Africa case with the authorities? And interesting to read testimonies and what other people have said, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of interested parties who are trying to put you down, and we want to be able to support you in this quest. So just we've got about a minute left. Give us some connections so people can carry on following you.
We're covering it on Twitter. So you can follow the case on Twitter. I have a friend of mine, Shabnam Palisa Mohammed, who's an attorney and an activist. She's posting constantly on Twitter and the ongoings of the case itself. So Twitter would be the ideal place. We're also trying to highlight what's going on in radio interviews and things like that. Mm-hmm. I have a website, drshankarachetty.com, drshankarachetty.com. You can go there and you'll see a lot of information. I'm also on YouTube a lot. Mm-hmm. And on this coming Sunday, at 2 o'clock South African time, we want to host a Twitter Spaces meeting where we can get everyone around the world to have an open discussion about where we need to go.
Okay, Dr. Shankarachetty, thank you very, very much. Incredibly interesting story about how COVID can be beaten with relatively simple and easily available medicines, but which has put a lot of people's noses out of joint. But 0% mortality, you can't argue with that. Dr. Shankarachetty, I'll just spell it out, S-H-A-A-N-K-A-R-A-C-H-E-T-T-Y. And that's the website, youjustadd.com. Thank you very much, sir. Very interesting talk. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. Thank you for this afternoon's show. And join me tomorrow at the same time. This is us. This is all of us for on this Monday afternoon. Thank you very much.